Good day, and welcome to episode 5 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week, we turn our attentions to the arts sector. Our special guest on our July 9th, 2020 Zoom meeting was Miranda Mulholland, a Guelph-raised musician, record label owner, and tireless advocate for artists' rights. She spoke to us about arts during and after the pandemic, well aware of the fact that the arts community was in deep crisis before COVID hit us. We also were privileged to hear on this episode from Councillor Kathy Downer and Guelph Arts Council Executive Director Patty Broughton. You'll also hear from Councillor Phil Ault, and I couldn't help jumping in too since I make my so-called living in the arts. Our moderator was Hina Mistry. Miranda begins by telling us a bit about her own background. Take it away, Miranda.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thank you, James, for listing off a few things that I've done. I've spent the last 20 years as a professional musician. I went to McGill for opera, and I played fiddle in the pub to pay my rent, and I kind of got sucked into to folk music. But yes, I blame you, James, because I did do a songwriting course at Author conference when I was a kid. So thanks a lot. But this career has been really interesting because I got into music just around 2000, which was when the digital economy kind of came upon us. And that was the era of Napster, and that was the era of when downloading started and piracy for music. And so it was exactly the wrong time to get into music as a career. And I worked so hard, and I kept kind of hitting all of these bars that I had sort of set out for myself that would be measures of success. So when I first moved to Toronto, I met the guys from Blue Rodeo because I toured opening for them a few times in different bands, and we'd become pals. And I remember talking to Ann Lindsay, who is Jim Cuddy's fiddle player forever. They went to high school together, and she's wonderful. And I thought, I want to be the next Ann Lindsay, you know. And Ann Lindsay has a beautiful house in Toronto, and has played on lots of records. And then a few weeks later, I got the phone call to be Ann Lindsay's sub in Jim Cuddy Band. And so I was sort of the next Ann Lindsay. And yet none of the other bars of success on the financial side came to me. So now I've played on, in the last 20 years, like over, I think over 100 records by now. Of amazing artists, Cowboy Junkies, who I know James knows, Sarah Sleen, Royal Wood, Donovan Woods. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I've played on a number of TV shows and film, and then put out my own solo records and, yeah, various bands, toured for 7 years with Great Lakes Swimmers. But it just never, I was never making the same amount that my peers who'd come way before me. So people who were a little older than I was, who got into it, just because of where we were, because of the digital economy. And as James sort of referred to, you know, the valuation of music. When did it go from being, you know, it went from being a $20 CD to, you know, you $9.99 for all the music in the world that has ever been made. And this is really troubling. So as soon as I sort of realized that it wasn't just me, I mean, this is very hard. It's hard enough to be an artist, as you all probably know, just waking up every morning and trying to do something that you feel is important and beautiful and make some meaning out of your life or whatever you're trying to do. And the imposter syndrome and all of the things that weigh people down, you know, it's hard enough to do that without sort of always coming back to the bottom line and just, why am I not making this? Why am I not making a living at this? As soon as I sort of realized that it wasn't just me, this was all of my colleagues and my peers having the same problems. And we were, as long as we started being honest about it and talking about it, I have a story where I started a music festival in Muskoka that James has played. And I texted my friend, Justin Rutledge, who's a multi-Juno Award winner, and nominated. And I said, you know, what are you doing on the August long weekend? Are you free? And he texts back and said, oh no, I have been booked up for ages. And then he texted again a few minutes later and said, oh, did you mean as a musician? I thought you wanted to rent my Airbnb. you know, and this is an incredible musician who had to rely on these other income streams that are, because he couldn't make a living. He would tour and he would lose money. And the myth that we were told at the time of the digital revolution was, okay, so you're not making very much from your streaming, but you can make a lot on the road. Go on the road, go tour. You'll make money at the merch table. And that's just not realistic, because touring was always sort of a loss leader in order for you to sell your CDs. And it's not realistic for a lot of people, because women, for example, and caregivers, it's very hard for me. I was going on the road with Great Lakes Swimmers and most of them were dads. But if I had a child, I don't think that they'd be very welcome on the tour bus. So it's challenging, the road. And of course now we're up against one of the most serious crises in 100 years. And of course the road, we're not even allowed to do that. We can't gather, we cannot play, we're not allowed to sing. So this is a really challenging time. And again, it's really showing the most vulnerable in our communities. And that goes for, you know, racialized individuals and people of color, and in our music ecosystem, that's the artists. And so what I've been doing in the last 4 months, really, the Junos was sort of when it really hit our community. The Junos were canceled in March. It was my first time being nominated for my own work. I've been on lots of bands that have been, but it's not really the same. So it was exciting. I was really ready to go, although I'd taken on too much, as usual. So there was a first wave of relief that I didn't have to go. But then, you know, then it kind of hit. Oh God, this isn't going to be just a month and then we can resume our lives. But in the last 4 months, I spent a lot of time lobbying government, trying to make sure that I'm at those tables. And luckily I've been part of these talks on every level of government. So here in Toronto, part of a panel with Mayor Tory, I was on the ministerial panel for music with Minister McLeod, and then had some meetings with Heritage Minister Guibeau. And so it's sort of, I feel as though it's my job as the only artist at the table to keep reminding every level of government that within our music ecosystem, artists are the most vulnerable. I've helped conduct 2 studies, one from Music Canada that we did it back in April, that polled artists to see how they were feeling about this, not just financially, which is dire, and there's some really interesting stats that came out of that, including that artists actually employ almost 4 people, each artist. So not only are we creators of content and creators of ideas and the arts, which are so important, but we're also employers and we're small businesses, which is another thing that we have to remember. But the other part that I wanted to track was, how is this affecting artists creatively? Because, you know, there was that myth of, okay, now you're going to go and write the great Canadian novel. You've got all this time. What are you going to do? Just go write songs. And that's just not the reality. We found that the vast majority of artists are radically unmotivated to create. This is not the worry, the stress, the anxiety is crippling. And so the second study that's coming out next week is a little bit more, I wouldn't say professional, but it's we did it with Abacus Data, which is an incredible polling station in Ottawa, which is very, it's known to the government and they're very trusted. And again, some of the same questions, but just a little bit deeper dive. And the one thing that I really wanted to track was, how are artists going to feel about going back to work? Because a lot of people, you go back to work, you go back to your office, you know how to get there. You can have some protocols in place so that you can make sure that you're safe. But for an artist to go back on the road, when that is possible, it's getting in a van or bus with a whole bunch of people and then going from town to town, hotel to hotel, so many contact points. Every venue would be different. A lot of them you've never been to. New staff, new crowds, merch table. What does the merch table look like? That's where you make some of your money. People can't be picking up and putting down. And do you want to go out and say hello to your fans? So we're tracking kind of how artists feel about coming back to work. So that's being published, I think, next week. But the high-level results are pretty staggering. One of the things we found was that, you know, international touring artists, and I would consider myself that only because my band makes, we do most of our touring in the US and the UK. I don't really feel great about going back to the US anytime soon, or the UK, to be honest. And, you know, it's not really practical for me to be able to fly over, quarantine for 2 weeks, and then start a tour. That just, the finances just don't work. And especially if, you know, the capacity issues and what does that look like if it's a quarter capacity, but then that's a quarter ticket price. I mean, it's just very, very difficult. But most international touring artists, and that's, again, like not the Jim Cuddies of the world, but that's just working musicians, had sort of an average of 118 gigs a year, which is a lot, but I think that's, I'm not surprised. That's an average. And it's gone down to 8. And 53% of the artists that we surveyed have nothing booked until the end of the year, before the end of the year. So it's a really concerning thing, and it's a crisis. But I also see it as an opportunity, because again, the cement is wet again, and we can kind of figure out if there are changes that we can make on a policy side. This is a time to fight for copyright reform. There are a couple things that we've been trying to do for the past 3 years that would actually put money in artists' pockets. And now is the time to do them. If there was a good reason before, there's an even better reason now. And I think this is a really great opportunity to take a deep look at our industry and find some systemic problems and try to address them. So that's where we are. And I think they sort of summed that up. I hope that was okay.
Yeah, thank you so much. I actually read your, on your website, like the letter that you had, you know, presented in your lobbying efforts. And it was just good to hear you talk about them, because I did think it expanded on those quite a bit. And yeah, like just like the traveling, like just how unsafe, like you mentioned it, but I didn't realize until you sort of talked about it now, like how unsafe it will be for musicians to work and do like the regular, you know, the gig work that they normally do. So thank you. Like, I appreciate that. And it's really insightful. The other thing I also found was really interesting about what you said too, is how much it's also affecting like writers as well. And cause I have a friend who she's a creative writer. She had gigs signed on for, I guess, like speaking at writers' festivals and things too. And she's like, they've all dried up, and then it's hard to find freelance work and, you know, like all these things. So this is incredibly insightful. And also thank you for the advocacy that you're doing for artists. Like, I'm sure that everybody, you know, is really appreciative of the hard work that you've been doing as well. So we have a list of prepared questions, but I was wondering if, I'll just ask the prepared questions first. And then Kathy Downer wanted to speak about something related that would be also helpful. Okay, so I guess I was wondering, what are some of the ways that the community can support local artists during lockdown? What are things that we can do to actually help in advocating, like in your advocacy, or just help, you know, as individuals, that would help and to support artists during this lockdown?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of people really want to help artists. And I think people, you know, it's like when you go to the coffee shop and you want to buy ethically sourced coffee, and that's your sort of seal of approval that you're doing something right and you feel good about where you're getting your food. And so I think a lot of people want to do the same for artists, but they don't quite know how. There's so many choices out there. And, you know, since the digital revolution, it's really moved into consumer convenience rather than ethically sourced music. So one of the things that you can do is subscribe to a streaming service. So whichever one you use, don't use the free tier. It actually pays more to the artist if you have a subscription. I mean, fractionally more, but that's one thing to do. The most important thing would be find artists and buy their merchandise or their CDs and or their downloads from their website, from the artist directly.
Ironically, Miranda was talking to us about the pros and cons of digital technology in the arts sector, because at that moment, we lost her to the ether on our Zoom call. So our moderator, Hina Mistry, quickly switched to a brief chat by Councillor Kathy Downer about some local initiatives around arts support. We'll go to Kathy now, and then when we find Miranda again, you'll hear her again.
So I can talk about the task force and some of the things that, you know, provide some new information around funding right now, but I really don't know about writers myself. So, but I will, so there's a mayor's task force on the economic recovery, and there's three councillors on it, and the each with a different focus. There's large business, small business, and then there's arts and culture. So I've been sort of doing some outreach on the arts and culture part, speaking to various artists in the city, and trying to connect them with ways that they can source some funding or pivot whatever they're doing. And it's part of, it's not just arts and culture, it's also tourism. So, but there's a real connection with the two of them. So one of the things that has come out of it, and I would suggest, one of the early issues that came up, can we do another community benefit grant? And that was sort of thinking of nonprofit and arts groups in the city as well. And it just so happens that they're out of a dividend that the city had around the whole hydro issue that we had a few years ago. That was over $1 million, and we'd had a community investment strategy come to council around that, spending part of that money and actual for the regular community benefit that we have, investments that we have every year. Strategy came last fall, and it had a number of criteria that we would use in order to disperse those funds. And so there was probably around 300,000 identified for each year, and then for this year, we got it up to 350. So we brought I brought a motion forward to council that in identifying how we disperse those funds, that we put that towards emergency and resiliency funding. So the funding will go to organizations that in order to help them through the COVID. So that was what it was really, really about. But I did get some other good information the other day, because I was talking to Dana Evans, the manager of Tourism and Culture, about artists and what we can be doing for artists. And I noticed Patty Broughton's on here as well from the Arts Council, and she may be able to provide some information too about what's happening in the arts community. But because there's a gap, right? When you look at that funding is mostly for charities and it's for nonprofits. But what I did find out now is that they're going to change that, and the program, there are now opportunities for artists and unincorporated individuals to apply for that 300 in that 350. And information will be coming forward about that. So I think that is really good. So what it'll be, the funding will be, it'll be geared towards that emergency and resiliency funding. But I'll just read what Dana has said in her email. Overall, the intention of funding will be to explore alternative models to ensure financial sustainability, develop program innovation, and strengthen the capacity of the organization, businesses, individuals. The intent is not to replace already lost revenue or payroll, but to support moving something forward that could not move ahead otherwise. So that'll be launched in the next coming weeks, and there'll be 50% of that will go out in August. So they're trying to do a very quick turnaround, and then with a follow through for the remainder in September and October. So I wanted to let everybody know and pass that along, and in the arts community, or if you have connections, and that might be new information for Patty as well. The other area that there is funding available, and it is through the local tourism office, so the regional RTO4, the Regional Ontario Tourism Office, and it's called RTO4. And they have funding available up to 15,000, and then there's even seven times that available for different for different things. They always have had that money available to, they call it investments. It's not on their website, but they give it to local organizations like the Tasty Tours. I don't know if you remember them. They provided her with funds this year to do a cookbook type thing from different places. So to pivot. And they're looking at that funding now to pivot groups in the tourism or individuals to do some sort of anything to do with telling a story. So I think of the Storytellers Guild, I think of that type of thing, and how to pivot to social distancing or virtual virtual types of tourism and promoting. And that, I think there's opportunity for artists in that as well. I know art in the street was able to access some of that funding. I know individual artists that have been doing, not just in this community, but other communities, organizations, and individuals are able to access that funding as well. And I'm going to put in the chat the person to call for that. It's Andrea at RTO4. And she will help anybody work through what is it that you do, how can we help you pivot, and what kind of a budget will you have, and how can we help you. And she's very, very willing and quite enthusiastic in helping individuals and organizations to access that funding. So and they've just recently got more funding from the province to disperse as well. So you can pass that along to anybody you know that may have some ideas around this as well. So that's sort of what I wanted to put out there. And I think it's good news for the city's own community investment fund, that we're able to expand that beyond the nonprofits to individual artists and individuals not going on incorporated. So I don't know if Patty had anything to add to that. I see she's on the screen as well.
Yeah, I appreciate the update because Dana and I are in pretty regular contact, but I hadn't heard about the timeline in terms of it starting as quickly as it will. So that's really good news to hear that. I'm also so pleased that this funding is going to be also available to individuals, because that's one of the things that the Community Investment Program, for all the great things that it helps happen in the community, it's not usually available to people who are individuals or unincorporated groups. So that's really wonderful to see that extra support this year through the through that $350K. That's wonderful. And we're pleased at the Arts Council if there's ways that we can help facilitate that. I know Dana and I have had conversations about, you know, some ways that the Arts Council might be able to be helpful in getting funding out to artists in the community, for sure. Yeah, I've been very pleased to be serving on the Mayor's Task Force with Kathy and with my colleagues at the Arts Council. We've been ongoing through this crisis, just talking to a lot of artists and arts organizations, trying to help them on a fairly one-on-one basis, just access resources and supports. And also, you know, I participated recently. Mike Schreiner had a culture sector roundtable that a few folks, especially from some of our local festivals, were present to talk about their concerns and ways that the provincial government at least might be able to help out, and some of the supports that around rent and around, you know, CERB and things like that that could be extended, and some other funding related supports that could be extended to artists and arts groups, just to help us weather this and get through. Jim Duffield of Royal City Studios and I, we followed up that sector meeting with a presentation to the provincial committee that Mike Schreiner serves on around economic and finance. And also something that's come about all of this that I'm so pleased about, it's kind of one of those plus sides of this happening, is that I think people have realized how it's pretty easy actually to stay connected with each other on the internet. So around the province, a group of people in positions like mine at community arts councils have come together to form an alliance, and that group is making a submission to that provincial task force as well. And I've just seen that paper this week that's been prepared, and we at Guelph Arts Council are signatory to that. So I'd be happy to make that available in some way and share it with anyone who's here. I'll put my email in the chat, and if anybody wants to contact me, then that would be great. But I think that's all.
Awesome. Thank you both for that really helpful information. So Miranda is back, and I was wondering if Miranda, you could continue just, I guess finish off with what you were saying about, or start, leave off, continue from where, what you were saying about how we can support artists better.
You bet. Yeah, sorry about that. We're all pivoting. So buying merchandise directly from artists is the number one way to support artists at any time. Obviously, commissioning, I'm speaking about music, but, commissioning a painter or whatever you can do in that, but buying from directly from the artist helps. But there's other ways of helping that are even free, you know, creating playlists or reviewing things. If you go on Apple or Amazon or whatever you do and you actually write a review, that does bump up the product in the algorithms. So there are free things that you can do. The one thing that you should not do is find your music on YouTube, because YouTube pays 1/20th of what Spotify pays. So that would be those are my top three tips. On my website, I have an advocacy page, and on that page has a lot of different ways that people can help, depending on whether you're a consumer, whether you're an artist, whether you're in government, and whether you're in the industry. There's certain ways that can help.
Awesome. So thanks for those tips, because I think, I had no idea that, you know, the differences in YouTube versus Spotify and the review system. Like, that's really helpful. A few people in the chat had questions about what you had said about the fight for copyright reform. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that and talk about what you've been doing and what you guys have been asking for.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a couple things that are that exist in our copyright law that have been around sort of from the time of the digital revolution for over 20 years. And some of them were supposed to be temporary, and then some of them were implemented and then never got changed. So one thing that affects me is the definition of sound recording in our Copyright Act. So I've I know this sounds really it's a bit dry, but it's really important. And the definition of sound recording means that even though I played fiddle on every episode of Republic of Doyle, which was on CBC for a very long time, now on Netflix, it's syndicated around the world. The composer gets paid every time that is played around the world, but even that the performer does not. So I don't make any money other than the first time that I was in the studio, you know, and I made my union $200 to play on for the episodes. So that's just because of the definition of what that means. So that's something that could be changed quite easily and with no cost to the taxpayer. And that would make a significant difference to my income. So that's just one example of sort of these quirks in our copyright system that actually do affect artists. There's a couple more I've got on my website as well. There's a few other ones. One of the biggest ones is the broad safe harbors. And there was an excellent report that came out last year called Shifting Paradigms that was led by the chair MP Julie DeBruzin, who is now the parliamentary secretary to heritage, to Minister Guibeau. And she led a real broad 360 look at what is wrong with our system. And in the report, Shifting Paradigms, it did actually point to this safe harbors, because that's why YouTube can get away with paying so little. It's still relying on the pretending that it's a dumb pipe, that it's just the conduit for information, rather than actually taking ownership of the fact that it's a website that has user uploaded content and they are making income from it, from ad based, but also they're recommending to you what to watch. So it's gone from being that dumb pipe to being a real player. And Google makes more money than anyone ever has in the history of the world. So they have a lot of money for lobbyists.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Again, like, thank you for this sort of discussion about this information about like online infrastructure and how it doesn't always like benefit artists. I'm going to move on. Phil wanted to speak about other forms of infrastructure and the arts. Phil, I'll just call on you to ask to say your piece.
Okay. Yeah, and thanks very much, Ehina. First of all, I want to thank Miranda and Kathy and Patty for being present. I think it's fairly important for us to appreciate that artists are very resilient, but they cannot, as Miranda says, pivot forever. And what struck me about that last comment that Amanda made was that supporting artists in some senses is like supporting local merchants. So if you think about music or you think about the arts globally, maybe we should be buying locally. But that leads to another point, and its appeal to both the Mayor's Task Force and to Guelph residents to not lose sight of infrastructure as absolutely essential to the arts. And what concerns me is, as we are going to be facing a certain financial crunch, I am very concerned about losing the impetus for the public library and for the potential for performance spaces in there. And I'm hoping perhaps Miranda and Kathy and maybe Patty can speak about this, that the River Run, for example, was a huge boost to artists in Guelph, as was the Guelph Youth Music Center. And if we look at those economic multipliers in a time of recession, which is what we're in, this is something that's needed to get the economy growing beyond the arts, but also using the arts as a catalyst, as a jumping off point for hiring construction workers, for making certain that positive infrastructure programs get going. I mean, it's no secret that even as far back as Plato's, knowing that cities don't thrive on commerce, they thrive on the arts. So I'm hoping that this, for the Mayor's Task Force in particular, but Miranda, also for you, that there is consideration of the value of infrastructure in a time of recession such as we are facing right now.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. And I think, again, you know, never waste a crisis. And there are That's points to be made. Yeah, I think it was Churchill. But yeah, I think there are points to be made for, arguments to be made for making change at all levels that can impact a rebuild. And I think we have to really look at that as the rebuild. Like, we're in this and we have to bridge, but we gotta think about the other side and what's going to get us back. The Youth Music Center meant a lot to me. That's where I was a Suzuki kid. So I think that's fundamentally been a part of my life, and also the library. And my mother is a champion of the library. So go get him.
Thanks. So James wanted to say something about streaming services.
Thanks, Hina. And yeah, thanks, Miranda. Miranda, if we have a slight disagreement, which is horrible to think of, I'm more grumpy and irritated and militant about streaming services. And the reason is this: when you mentioned that, you know, go to Spotify instead of YouTube because it pays 20 times better, it's still demeaning, insulting. What it does pay those streaming services, in my view. So what I think, do we say, okay, let's look at the best of the worst scenarios and adopt those, or do we try, but, and I know I, you know, you can find me on Spotify too, even though I have a grumpy song about it. Where is our best energies put? Do we encourage people to go to those revenue sources that still do not support artists, because that's all that's offered? Or do we spend our efforts in educating and looking for the cultural shift that I think we need, where, and this is a question I'm putting out to everyone, because I'm now officially a senior citizen, in my career, I've noticed the erosion of, just in general, value that we place as a society on artists in general. And coming from an artist, that sounds whiny. However, it's quite pervasive. And there are countries that do historically honor their artists. And because of that honoring and the recognizing the importance of the value that they provide, we find ways to reward them and keep them sustainable. And the work that, Miranda, you've done lots of work in schools too, and there's people on this call that do it. sometimes if I'm doing something in a school or speaking to younger people, there's no reason that they should even know that if they're trying to grab music for free or next to free, they're not aware that how that actually impacts artists. You know, you can stand in front of them and say, well, here's how it impacts me. I can't make my art anymore if I'm not rewarded in a way that allows me to do it without the stress, economic stresses that we all face. So I really think that re-education process is key. But also, just tack in another comment about what Phil was just asking about. We were talking just before the official meeting started with Ken, who's a chorister, that when you're talking about infrastructure, for the long-term vision, do we even know now that people will go back to wanting to gather in large groups to watch performances, whether it's dance or theater or music, or whether we need to shift our thinking around where people are going to feel safe and what's the economic model that makes that sustainable. So that's a lot, but I'll leave that there.
Well, I'd love to respond, because you're totally right, you know, and I don't have, you know, I'm not sticking up for any of the streaming services. By no means. I mean, I certainly suffer the same way. You know, we had the access to be on some playlists for Spotify, but you know, that's my coffee. So it's not, you know, that's not a sustainable revenue source. The reason that I harp on YouTube is that in order for any of us to have any kind of negotiating power, there has to be there's somebody over here who's letting all the water out of the bathtub. And so we don't have any clout to try to fight for more per stream when YouTube's giving it away for free. And until we can get the end of Rod Safe Harbors and YouTube has to be accountable, if they suddenly paid even as much as Spotify, they would be millions of dollars immediately back into Canada's industry. But until someone can face up to the big bad giant, there's a slippery slope. We have no way of allowing this. I mean, you could take your music off Spotify, but then what does that do? Discoverability, right? So it's a big problem, and it's really frustrating. I was campaigning in Washington and lobbying down there, and it was so obvious to me when I went in those meetings who had just been in before, because obviously it was YouTube had just been in, and they were talking about, well, YouTube's great because Justin Bieber made it big, you know, and it's just such a stupid argument, but I certainly get it. But to the erosion as well is interesting, because what did everybody do as soon as the pandemic hit? Everybody started playing for free on their platforms. So we're doing it to ourselves, you know, and I have a real problem with it. I mean, I get that people needed to connect, and they want to make, you know, they want to make pay what you can, or they can do online ticketed shows. But I think that complete erosion again of that's the first thing that everyone turned to is problematic. But I don't think it's about free. I think it's about people wanting a connection. That's why we do this. We're storytellers. We want that connection with an audience, really missing it. I mean, it feels like almost a drug that we haven't had, you know, and I think that's probably why people all pivoted to that. But we certainly don't do ourselves any favors in that grand scheme of argument. As far as how people are going to return, I was part of another study. I just feel like the last 4 months have been studies and surveys. You probably feel the same. But there was a really amazing one that came out a couple weeks ago by Abacus again, and it's about how people are going to feel about returning to the marketplace, how consumers will feel about going back. Unsurprisingly, 50% of all Canadians don't want to go see a show in the U.S. forever. And that was polled about a month and a half ago. So the same study is happening. I think it's in market this week. So we'll have new data and see where that goes. But I can share all of these with you. I could find the Abacus study, but it's really interesting.
For sure. Thanks. And if there's things that you'd like to, you know, to be distributed to the like attendees here, please feel free to send it to James and I, and we can make sure we have a weekly newsletter, so we can make sure it goes into that, the bullhorn.
Wait.
So the next major topic I kind of wanted to ask you about was, just, you know, you were saying the way, you know, just considering the lack of safety or just the safety concerns that come with traditional forms of performing, are going to be with us for, for a long time, right? So how have artists, performing artists, been innovating? Like, what have they been doing to, like, what have they been doing to continue performing in different ways, virtually or otherwise? And Ron East had a question that was sort of tied into this is, you know, all of the sort of performing arts infrastructure that we have, like, how do we continue to do art during a pandemic since it will not go away and this is the new reality? What do we do with spaces such as the River Run Center? We need to reimagine a new creative means to present our work. So I think I'll ask you to speak to that, but I think perhaps the other folks on the call who are, you know, more involved with the city and dealing with infrastructure as well, like if they could also speak about that after Miranda speaks as well.
Yeah. So artists have been, you know, innovative as always, pivoting around, trying to think of new ways to come up with, again, that connection or how can I have a sustainable income? The answer is it's not sustainable. There's a lot of problems with digital models, especially in the summer. I mean, a lot of people don't really feel like attending live concerts via Zoom when it's beautiful out. And that's a challenge. And also just saturation, I think. We're all a little bit sick of our screens right now. Well, I certainly am. But some interesting things have come up. Matt Masters in Calgary has come up with curbside concerts. So he started a whole booking across the country. I think he's got several different cities now. And you can book an artist to go. And he shows up with his van and he does a little, he can do a concert from the curb, on the top of his van. And he's got several other artists in various cities who are doing this. I mean, again, this is innovative and he's actually, I think he left his job at CKUA at the radio station to pursue this full time. So he's obviously making hay while the sun shines, which is great. Some artists have been doing drive-in shows. There's a big festival in Ottawa that's doing a drive-in. But I had heard from one of the agents that, you know, wasn't selling incredibly well or quick. And I think a lot of people don't feel excited to go sit in a hot car and watch music. So again, I just feel like there's so many temporary measures that are being taken just to try to, you know, bridge that gap. As far as the infrastructure too, I think one of the really interesting options that we have now and opportunities is some of these spaces to make them available to smaller groups, to make them available so people can create content or work. So something like the River Run Center, making, you know, having, letting artists in to record a live performance, where they wouldn't necessarily, like, without an audience obviously, but to create some new content for them for down the road, or to for their EPKs or whatever they need. Doing that in, like, diners that can't open yet, doing that in interesting spaces. I think that could be a really cool thing. There's a diner here in Toronto that offered, you know, they can't open, they don't have a patio, but they said, you know, if you have a cool idea or you want to shoot a movie here, or you want to do something with a skeleton crew, sign up here or put in your applications and we'll give you that space, which I thought was really interesting and could be, you know, empty spaces used for artist practice.
James wanted to speak to the infrastructure issue.
Yeah, and thanks for that, Miranda. The River Run came up in Ron East's comment and question, and a comment I would have about venues like that, I think it has 800 seats, I think that's right. It was built, and I was part of the team that was advocating for it, kind of at the end of an era, and I don't know if it's been your experience, Miranda, too, as a touring artist, because of shifts, societal shifts, so that artists that are making non-mainstream music or dance or theater, you can't really see them on television anymore. You don't hear that on mainstream radio. It became a lot harder to fill an 800 seat hall just before the COVID too. So a lot of, you know, I would tour through and go, well, what happened to that concert hall? Well, it didn't make it because the times have shifted. So there's a particular infrastructure thing in Guelph, as in Miranda's mom's helping with this too, the looking for spaces that are more around 150 or up to 300 seats will serve two purposes. It means that you might fill those 150 seats if it's a pleasing venue, but as we design them, we can address some of those safety concerns as well. So I think that there's a rethinking that has to be done with that. And I wanted to know if Miranda, you can comment on that as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. One thing that we did when I, this is Music Cities studies, again, with the studies. I swear I do actually make my living as a musician. I don't just do studies. But the Music Cities I was involved with here in Toronto. And one of the things that's the most important pillar of a music city is a venue ladder. So you need to have those small coffee houses where artists start. And you need to be able to build up to whatever the River Run or whatever that is. And we see that with I'm on the board of Massey and Roy Thompson Hall. So we really see that within our halls, we have smaller options. So we're redoing Massey right now. It's I don't know if you know this, the Grand Old Dame is getting a facelift, and it's stunning. It's going to be amazing. And because of the venue ladder problem, we have a new venue that's being put in behind Massey, which will be more of a development room and kind of a black box room that can be multi-purpose and multi-size, as well as now in Centuries. I don't know if you've been, but downstairs there's a bar, and that's going to be a venue as well. So we're kind of working on that venue ladder. But I think that's one of the things to keep an eye out in your city, always making sure that there is a venue ladder, because when that falls, when that breaks, it's very, very hard for artists to work their way up. London, Ontario is a great example of a city that realized they had a problem and then started a music office and then went after it. And then they got the Junos. So, and the Country Music Awards. So they really focused on that and they fixed that venue ladder problem, which I thought was pretty great. City Winery in New York, they're kind of a behemoth and they have a lot of venues all over the place. But one thing that they did was very smart in their New York venue. There's a curtain, a beautiful curtain that can sort of enclose part of the venue. And it's a sort of dinner theater-y, like high-end food, kind of like what Hugh's Room wanted to be, a listening room. But the great part is they can be 800, or you can move the curtain around the audience and it's 400, or you can be 150, and the artist never feels like, oh, I didn't sell out. Like, it still looks like a full room. And so having that kind of flexibility, I think, is really important. And again, that is why you need artists on all of the decision-making. I'm the only artist on the Massey Hall, Roy Thompson Hall thing, and there have been some times where there was no sight. There was no light and sound lock upstairs for 1 second, and I had to say, "Wait a second, what?" You know, because if you don't have some, you have blind spots.
Phil also wanted to jump in about infrastructure.
Yeah, and thanks, actually, but really, the real issue, as I'm listening to your comments about concerns about people not returning to the arts, I'm not going to be that pessimistic, and I don't think that's what you were intending. I think it's going to be a challenge. And I think that the infrastructure issue is going to be significantly challenging. And this is why I don't want to lose sight of it. I am very concerned that Guelph is going to lose the opportunity for a Baker Street library if we say we can't afford it because of a recession. The other challenge, however, is that what we clearly know from this COVID crisis is that HVACs are a significant factor in communicating disease. And so consequently, what we need to also look at in infrastructure development are significant engineering changes that are going to counter some of the problems that we currently have with the filtration of air. Ironically, it seems that we didn't learn anything from Legionnaires' disease in some senses. We now know, and we should have known right from the start, that the airborne elements of COVID and the clustering together of people in tight quarters are clearly going to infect people. So now, for the arts, we have a real challenge. We have to get people out. I don't blame people for not wanting to go to a drive-in concert, but we need to also sanitize the facilities is perhaps the best way to put it, and that's going to be one hell of a challenge as we re-engineer our way out of this thing.
Yeah, if you look at the study, because I'm not pessimistic, but I think there's an opportunity with the study. You can see where sort of, will people feel comfortable if there's testing? Will people feel comfortable if there's tracing? Will they feel comfortable if there's temperature checks? And you can kind of see where, how people, you want to turn sort of, I think it's orange, but you want to turn the orange or yellow into green, you know, so you can figure out what people will need in order to feel comfortable going back. And I think that can help sort of guide some of the protocols, and as well as very clear and consistent messaging. You know, you see in the UK, there's been some really terrible messaging. They stay alert, you know, what? That was frightful. So they need, there's going to have to be very clear protocols as to how people feel about going back into, and if there is sort of an HVAC, you know, that can be stated on a health card or something that people know that this building has these measures in place. I think that will be really important.
For sure. So Miranda, I'm going to go back to something that you said before, which was never waste a crisis. And so with that, I kind of wanted to segue into another question I had about, you know, just the recent conversations about systemic racism in the, you know, in across like institutions and fields. And this is something you also brought up in your letter, your advocacy letter on your website. But I was wondering, what are the ways in which artists are also, I guess, looking to tackle like systemic racism in the arts, and in this crisis in particular? Like, what is being done, or like, what's happening with that, I guess?
Yeah, again, I think this goes back to artists being storytellers. I'm learning every day. I think, and this is my own white privilege, but I was not aware of quite the degree. And so I'm trying to learn and listen. And, you know, I'm part of a few different councils and in groups that hopefully we were taking, you know, a really hard look at ourselves and what is the makeup of our board and who are the decision makers. So I'm the chair of the Music Canada Advisory Council, which is a group of diverse individuals from across the country that are sort of the, we're there for the presidents of the major labels to try to look at what needs to be done in our industry, in the ecosystem broadly, and in a micro way. So obviously this has come up, and it's key, and it's never been more important than now. And again, you know, we kind of have this time where the cement is wet, and we do have this opportunity to restructure and to figure things out. And, you know, I was talking to my friend Shoshona Kish, who is in a band called Digging Roots, which is amazing. She's incredible. And she had brought up that there isn't a single Indigenous woman signed to a major label. And, you know, that's insane ever, you know, this is crazy. So she, you know, she wants to make some change, and I want to help as much as I can in any kind of capacity. I know the Massey Hall, Roy Thompson Hall board, we're looking at our nominations and governance policies, which is where you can make a lot of these changes. And I do think there's been a real wake-up call, and I'm here to just support and listen and be an ally and be active, and, you know, recognize the benefits that I've had over the years.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Thank you so much for bringing that to light. I was also worrying along similar lines. I was also wondering, I guess when it comes to, and I think this is a problem that's also been, it touches like all different fields, but accessibility concerns, like even with accessing music and accessing the arts, like in this time of COVID. This came up, like I was teaching at Queen's, and, you know, like one of the things that came up with, okay, so we're moving things online, which makes things more accessible in some ways, in that if you have mobility issues, you now don't have to like go to a classroom that might not be in an accessible building and everything too. But then there were other accessibility concerns that came with like having, you know, learning content online, artistic content online. So I was wondering, again, in the middle of all this time where everything is moving online, how has accessibility perhaps come up in discussions around, you know, arts in the time of COVID?
You mean like physical accessibility or
all? Yeah, different forms.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been one of the challenges too, because a lot of these companies, you know, like the Facebook NAC thing, where they're offering $1,000 for creating content digitally, you know, and put it out. sure that there's some that more people can see it. I think digitally people have access to it. That's, you know, that's important. Maybe they're hearing artists that they never have before. In the Abacus study, they actually asked if people have discovered new artists, and they have, which is great. But again, if you're in a community that doesn't have internet access or solid, you know, that kind of stable connection that would be required to do that, then you can't access that money and that funding. And again, I think this is really uncovering just the vulnerabilities and the communities that are the hardest hit. But I think looking forward to any kind of post-COVID landscape, you know, I think somebody had said earlier, you know, we're all getting a lot better at this, and there are opportunities to have further reach. For example, I wrote a play that's being performed was going to be performed at the NAC in November. And, you know, obviously we're not going to do it the way that it was, but now it's a Remembrance Day show. It's a Remembrance Day sort of ceremony, but artistically done. But now it can go online and it could be available across the country. So, you know, that's a great opportunity for me to get my work out across the country when it would normally just be showed to 150 people in a smaller room. So, you know, yin yang. But I'm also happy to share anytime. I've got a lot of sort of best practices that we're using for Massey Ray Thompson to how to bring back audiences, how to bring back artists safely, how to do this properly. Because one thing that I don't want to see, and I'm really concerned about, and again, this is why this last study was done, because I don't want to race to the bottom for risk. I don't want artists to be, if someone doesn't take the job because they don't feel safe, so someone else will do it. You know, we're sort of notorious for undercutting each other, and I just that's a real concern of mine.
So Matt in the chat had asked, he said, I wonder what some of you working artists think about the value of a universal basic income in ensuring that everybody has the freedom to pursue self-expression in the arts with or without a profit motive. I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, I think we found in the studies too about the anxiety that artists are feeling right now, which is really contributing to their lack of creativity. And obviously UBI would be something that, you know, could take away that fear of eviction and not being able to eat. I will say though, there have been arguments, and I've read a few things. I think I need to do more reading, but there have been a couple of arguments about a UBI eroding copyright, eroding the rights that artists would then claim for their work. And that's been an interesting argument to kind of unpack. So I think I can't really stand very, I think I'd have to do more reading in order to have a proper stance on this. In my opinion, I think they should have continued with the UBI experiment that was happening in Ontario, which got cut off by Ford as he came into power, I believe, and they stopped that. But I thought that would have been really important.
That's all the time we have for this week. Miranda had lots more to say, and I urge you to check out her work and her advocacy at her website, mirandamulholland.ca. Special thanks to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gevert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. Thanks, as always, for listening.